From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the MSU Spartans march to the Final Four.
Do not count this team out.
Learning to teach, being a teacher in Michigan. Today, preparing teachers.
And that first year in particular, you're trying to keep your head above water, and there's so much coming at you that you know, some days you wonder what you got yourself into.
And evaluating them.
I'm a big believer that we want teachers to open their classroom doors.
Plus the challenges of filing taxes for same-sex married couples.
So they told them, do the same thing on your state return as you do on your federal return. But at the same time, they said, we don't recognize same-sex marriage. You cannot file jointly.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Teacher quality is one of the most important factors in how our kids do in school. So how do we make sure teachers know how to teach, and who gets to decide? I'm Cynthia Canty. As we begin our week-long series, Learning to Teach, we'll explore teacher evaluations, what works, what doesn't. That's today on Stateside. But first, lawmakers at the state capitol have begun their two-week spring break, but that does not mean there is not political news happening across the state and even to the south of us, news that we need to dig into. Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, co-hosts of It's Just Politics here on Michigan Radio, join me now. Hello, you two.
Hello, Cindy.
Hello.
Let's begin with this investigative report from Friday. It was making news all weekend about a controversial pardon by Governor Rick Snyder. Zoe, take it away.
Yeah, right. So this happened Friday. We found out about it by the reporting of AP reporter Dave Eggert.
Shout out
to Ed White and Dave Eggert at the AP. So here's basically what we know, what happened. Governor Snyder made 11 pardons last year at the very end of the year, back in December. 11 pardons. Governors, of course, can do this. Well, it turns out what we found out on Friday is that one of the pardons was for a drunk driving offense. And it just turns out that this gentleman who was pardoned by the governor happens to be the lawyer for the owner of 5-Hour Energy Drink that you've probably heard of.
Yes.
And this gentleman who owns 5-Hour Energy Drink, big donor to Republican governors.
The Chamber of Commerce that it was money that went to Republican gubernatorial campaigns, mm-hmm. and a lot of it went to back the gubernatorial candidacy in 2010 of Governor Rick Snyder.
Some $3 million. Hmm. So none of this looks very good. And there's a lot of folks and Democrats going, hey, since when does a governor pardon an offense like drunk driving? It's not something that normally happens.
Well, if you look at this list of pardons, the offenses were things like breaking and entering, carrying concealed weapons. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was clearly, you know, the most, you know, in terms of the effect on someone's life, probably the most inconsequential offense on that particular list.
And what does the governor say about the connections, as everybody's pointing to who this guy is the lawyer for?
Well, what he told the Associated Press was that you know, there was no financial link with his campaign, that there was no financial link at all, and that's a little bit of a stretch, because in fact there was, and you know, he even knew the attorney. I think I'm saying it right, Herbert Gaucher, and he had named him to a state economic development board.
And they've said yes, that they have met in person before. I believe there was a dinner, so these two gentlemen, the governor and Gaucher, know each other.
And it just looks bad, and really, this could not come at a worse time for the governor. That right now, you know, he wants to be focused on the ballot campaign in May. You know, he doesn't want something like this out there that really, you know, strikes at his credibility.
I think it too goes to that narrative that Democrats have pushed on this governor, which is that he looks out for the big guy, right? For mm-hmm. other fellow business folks, folks that are well off, and that the little guy isn't as taken taken care of. And so whether or not
if
that is true here,
whether or
it
not
fits
it's fair, it fits the narrative pretty
the
snugly.
Optics.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
Well, let's head a bit south now from Lansing to Indiana. And boy, social media blew up all weekend after Republican Governor Mike Pence signed this legislation known as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And it's a measure opponents say basically makes it okay to discriminate. And I bring this up because Michigan lawmakers are looking at their own version of this legislation known as RFRA.
Yeah, this has been around actually for 20 years at the federal level, that Bill Clinton signed it into law. And it was designed at the time to protect the rights of prison inmates to practice their religion, some things like that. And what's happened over time is the U.S. Supreme Court ruled, said, however, the federal law doesn't apply to state laws and state policies. And so if states want similar protections on their law books, they have to pass their own. Well, what we're seeing now in states with the marriage decision approaching is there's sort of this accelerated effort to get state-level Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, RFRAs, adopted. Well, the blowback on what happened in Indiana with Mike Pence is such that I think you could argue that Mike Pence has probably done more to stall RFRA in Michigan than anything the American Civil Liberties Union could have
done. Right. This is something that did pass the state house in the last session. Of course, though, legislation dies if it doesn't pass both houses and the governor doesn't sign it, which did not happen last year. But there is push among some conservatives in this legislature to push for RFRA. And I think Rick is absolutely right that this is going to lead many to go, hey, you know, do we really want this? Because, Cindy, as you said, social media, there's been, protests. But let's not forget,
we've got
too,
businesses
there's been
that,
economic that... decisions as well that have been made. We have Angie's List coming out saying we're not so sure about this. So it's economic implications as well as social.
Well, it was interesting that Governor Pence was making the rounds of the weekend Sunday talk shows saying he was going to elaborate and explain. And I don't believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that
the opposite.
He never once said exactly whom it was aimed at, ever.
There were folks who were counting. George Stephanopoulos, who did the interview, apparently asked half a dozen times, each time the governor unable to quite answer or unwilling to answer. It does not look good. Again, talking about optics here.
I wasn't there, but I think that what happened is that Governor Pence probably and his advisors failed to recognize that because of the Supreme Court case, the conversation surrounding this particular issue, the talking points that they use have changed.
Absolutely.
And speaking of, let's jump into the last thing to talk about. And that's the fact that Attorney General Bill Schuette's office delivered a brief to the U.S. Supreme Court setting out the state's defense of its same-sex marriage ban. And of course, as we all know, the court will be hearing arguments in that case next month in D.C.
Yeah.
Rick, what's the brief say?
Well, it's a 59-page brief, and it, you know, reiterates a lot of the arguments that the state has made until now. But the focus, and we saw this in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, we're seeing it again here, is now no longer on whether same-sex marriage or dual-sex marriage is better for children and for families. We've really seen a shift, and the arguments are now very, very, very much directed towards who should decide the issues. Should it be the federal courts, or should it be the voters and the states? And I would say this is probably a play to, in particular, Justices Breyer and Kennedy. Kennedy, who is a swing vote, but Justice Breyer, who sort of broke with his liberal colleagues on the court in the affirmative action case in 2014, another Michigan case which sort of breathed new life into Attorney General Bill Schuette's efforts in the DeBoer marriage case, that they said that when voters make a decision, that the courts and the government ought to afford them great, great deference.
Yeah.
And that's where the state in Michigan and the other states that have same-sex marriage bans on the books, that's where they're putting their chips.
And there is, Cindy, too, an element of politics here for Attorney General Bill Schuette, who most folks by now assume will run for governor come 2018.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he wants to be on the as close to the right side of this as possible. And so by him changing his his argument that this is less about traditional marriage that he is standing for, which he used to say is what this mm-hmm. argument was about, and now is about voter rights. It puts him at a different sort of bargaining reasoning that I think will be used when he does run in 2018, if he decides that he will, in fact, do that.
His political message has pivoted in the same direction as the legal argument.
Right.
Rick Pluta, Zoe Clark, co-host of It's Just Politics right here on Michigan Radio. As always, thanks you two.
You bet.
Thanks, Cindy.
All this week, we're asking, how is Michigan doing when it comes to turning out effective teachers? Before we hear from education experts, let's hear from someone on the ground, an educator. Samantha Esper is a chemistry teacher at Berkeley High School, and she's been a teacher for 5 years. Esper says there's a lot of negativity, a lot of criticism when it comes to how the media and the public talk about teachers. And that's something she says must change if Michigan wants to keep good teachers in state.
I want the media and the public to believe in teachers in general, to believe that we have some expertise in the field of education. Sometimes it seems like everyone thinks that they're an expert in education because everyone's gone to school. But to me, that's kind of like saying I could be a doctor because I've been to the doctor's office. Going through education as a student is really different than being a teacher or being in the career, kind of being in the trenches. So what I really want is for the public and the media to start believing more in teachers and trusting us to be trying things that truly are research-based, that we know what we're doing, and to also listen to our voices at a state level. Most of the decisions that are being made right now about education are being made by people who have never stepped foot inside a classroom except for as a student. And it really doesn't seem very logical to me that more teachers wouldn't be included in the conversation on what we can do to fix education.
Teacher Samantha Esper encourages people with and without kids to learn more about what their local schools are doing and to get involved. Still to come, our series Learning to Teach continues. Just how do we evaluate teachers in Michigan? And then, one teacher's recommendation for improving teacher prep, the apprenticeship model. That's all right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is wide agreement among education experts that teacher quality is the most important school-based factor on how students do in school. So how are Michigan schools of education doing in turning out effective teachers, and how do we measure that effectiveness? This week, we're beginning an in-depth series on Michigan Radio, Learning to Teach. Here with us is Michelle Richard. She specializes in education issues at Public Sector Consultants. Welcome back to Stateside, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us first off, let's get right ground level, how are teachers evaluated in our state?
Absolutely. So we have state law now that requires that every single educator is evaluated every single year. And that evaluation consists of two big components. First of all, we have administrators go into classrooms and have observations. So they'll take a look and see what's actually happening in the classroom. We also are looking at student growth, which is a relatively new addition to the teacher evaluation conversation. And we're looking at statewide assessment data, local data, to understand if children are really learning while they're sitting in the classroom.
Is this process fair? And by that, I mean, what does it mean if you're only evaluating on these student test scores and if you're basing it on student achievement? Is that okay? Because what if the child suffers from a learning disability or is homeless or has a hard home life? Should the teacher be held accountable for all of that as well?
So you're jumping right into the tough questions because I think you've really hit the heart of one of the biggest challenges of educator evaluation. So I'm a big believer that we want teachers to open their classroom doors and to have high quality feedback from their peers and from administrators about what's happening in their classroom. Too often teachers can close their door and they work independently and they never get quality feedback on their instructional practices. I think that we've come a long way in making sure that the classroom observation side of the equation is fair to teachers. Most districts in the state are using a vendor provided, so someone who does teacher evaluation for a living and has made sure that their evaluation tool is fair to educators, they use one of those observation models. They generally get trained by that vendor, and I think that we've come a long way to making sure that the observation side is fair for teachers. The student growth side is a lot more challenging. I tend to think that that's an important addition to the conversation. I think it's really critical to say it's not enough for teachers to teach the content. We must prioritize whether or not students are learning that content. Do we have a perfect measure for that? No. So generally, we've been talking about using statewide assessment data, so MEEP or the new version would be the M-STEP. But that doesn't cover every child. That doesn't cover every teacher because not all subjects are tested. And there's questions about whether or not a class size of 30 can give you enough data about an educator. So generally, when you see information about student growth, they'll be looking for multiple years of data. So a teacher who's been teaching fourth grade for 3 years, for example, would have data on potentially 120 students, which gives them a lot more, which gives all the data people who help us understand these numbers better data to build their determination of student growth on. But it is far from perfect. And I think we've seen our legislators tip a hat to that by delaying some of the implementation of requiring a bigger growth measure in teacher evaluations.
How does what we're doing in Michigan compare to other states?
So Michigan really took a big jump into teacher evaluation in 2009, which was about the same time that a lot of other states took this leap too. So there's an organization that's a national nonprofit called the New Teacher Project, and they had put out a report called The Widget Effect. And they came to the conclusion that 99% of educators were rated satisfactory. So in an evaluation system where you are rated satisfactory or unsatisfactory, we were only identifying 1% of educators as ineffective. And I think that just didn't jive with most people's common experience. If you ask teachers, if you ask parents, if you ask students, they would tell you that there are some teachers that are not as good as others, and our evaluation systems just weren't picking those things up. So President Obama and his administration, in the very, very first race to the top, encouraged states to really focus on teacher evaluation, and we saw a big jump in 2009 in the number of states who increased their requirements. That's not to say that Michigan wasn't conducting teacher evaluations prior, just the state requirements were much more lenient.
So it's toughened up, and it's become very charged. And I think you kind of, your reaction to the first question about how fair this process is leads me to the next question, which is, has this process become political in Michigan?
Absolutely. So we've had the legislature take a number of, or they've introduced and passed a number of bills around evaluation over the past 5 or 6 years. So they increased the expectations in 2009. In 2011, they came back and said we had some more work to do on these requirements, and they made some adjustments, and they also created the Michigan Council for Educator Effectiveness, which was an external group led by the University of Michigan's Deborah Ball. And they took a look at what can we really do around educator evaluation policy that is aligned with research, that's fair and equitable to teachers. And they came out with a report. And last year, 2014, we saw lawmakers try again to get some updates into the legislation so that we'd have some more consistent expectations for districts. But unfortunately, that bill wasn't able to pass the finish line.
You know, with all the research you have done, Michelle Richard, with everything you know, do evaluations tell the whole story about whether a teacher truly is or is not effective?
I don't think that any single measure ever tells the whole story, but I think that it gets us a lot further down the road. I said just a couple minutes ago how important I think this is. If your listeners kind of think about their common experience, I think that most people have an opportunity to have feedback in their professional life on a relatively regular basis. My boss sits next door, and he'll absolutely tell me if I can do better or if I should be doing something differently. And too often, our teachers don't have that quality feedback. And an imperfect measure, in my opinion, is better than no measure. And I think that we've put some safeguards in place so that we are not making high-stakes decisions like whether or not a teacher is laid off, whether or not a teacher is fired, based on a single observation in a classroom. I think the system we've set up has really worked hard to make sure that those evaluations, where teachers are rated highly effective, effective, minimally effective, or ineffective, that they're based on more than one measurement. So more than one classroom observation and more than a single moment in time for student growth. So often that student growth component is a combination of statewide test data and local test data, so that it's not, you know, what if Johnny had a bad day? Mm-hmm. Your test score, your student growth measure might be completely off. I think that most districts have tried to set up a system that makes a lot of sense to teachers and that is fair, but I do think we still have a long way to go.
And with that in mind, if you could be the ruler of the universe and set up the most perfect way possible to evaluate a teacher, what would that look like, Michelle?
So I do think that getting people in the classroom so that people can really be seeing what happens. And in my ideal world, I would have that feedback loop happen a lot more frequently for teachers. Right now, most of our evaluators are principals. And as many of us know, principals have a very big job description, and all of us only have so many hours in a day. So I would love to have evaluators and principals in the classroom all the time so that teachers are constantly getting feedback. We tell students that we don't want them to be surprised by a low grade on a test, right? We want to give them a lot of feedback that they haven't mastered a skill yet and they have work to do. And I would love for that same expectation to be set for our teachers so that if there's a problem or they're not performing or mastering a skill that we want them to, that they've had really regular conversations with their peers, with their principal to say, this isn't going as well as it should. What can we do differently to make sure that you as a professional are growing and that you're serving kids to the best of your ability?
Michelle Richard is a specialist in education at Public Sector Consultants. As always, thank you so much, Michelle.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Stateside. This is Stateside.
Opportunities.
The next idea.
Education is not a mechanical system. It's a human system. It's about people.
How should we prepare our teachers to step into the classrooms where our children await? It's a fiery debate in the world of education because it's forcing us to confront exactly what we think of as the role of the teacher. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea offers perspectives and ideas about teacher preparation based on his 22 years as a teacher. Keith Kindred teaches social studies at South Lyon East High School. Good to have you with us, Keith.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think is the difference between a good teacher and a not-so-good teacher?
Well, that's a question that defies a simple answer, but I think there are some commonalities to a good teacher. But I always tell people teaching is part science and part art. And we've all been to school, and we all know that teacher that has it. And very often there's an undefinable quality to it.
It's that secret sauce.
It's that secret sauce. And if it were as easy as coming up with the recipe for the secret sauce, we'd have solved this problem by now. But there's more to it, and I think that a good teacher is one who is grounded in good skills, good technique, good instructional strategies, all the kinds of things that you would learn at a college of education, but also one that connects with their students on a human level. And that's the art and the science balance.
Keith, you've been teaching for 22 years now. Can you take us back and remember what it was like those first couple of years?
I can. And, you know, I actually feel like I had some advantages over other newer teachers. First of all, it was a second or even a third career for me. So I was a little bit old. I was 27 years old when I was first in the classroom. I also went to Eastern Michigan University. I got both my degrees from there. And even that many years ago, and we're talking almost 25 years ago, I was a part of a program that got teachers, prospective teachers, student teachers, in the classroom earlier than was the norm at the time. So when I became a teacher, I felt like I actually had a fairly firm foundation. And yet, any first-year teacher will tell you, it's overwhelming. And that first year in particular, you're trying to keep your head above water, and there's so much coming at you that you... You know, some days you wonder what you got yourself into.
I know in your essay for the next idea, you said, I kind of feel bad for those kids I taught back in the early days. Well, everybody's got that learning curve.
They do. The difference with teaching is you're talking about children. You're talking about children's lives. And it's something, I don't just say that. I genuinely feel that. You know, I wish I could be the go back and be the teacher for them that I am now. But I just don't know how you do that.
But, okay, how did you get through the growing pains to become a better teacher, knowing that we see a lot of washing out in your profession where people just toss in the towel?
Absolutely. And I think this is where we can change some things at colleges of education and for preparing teachers. I basically did it the way I think most teachers back in the day did it, trial and error. And you just work your way through it. And you have mentors and you have other resources, I'm talking back when I started, that you can tap into. But we didn't have the structural supports, perhaps, that do exist today and that maybe we need more of.
I'm wondering, with these new teachers you're working with, their level of preparation, do they seem to be more or less prepared than you felt you were when you stepped in there?
I think they're generally more prepared. I feel like they're as well prepared or better prepared than people of my generation were. The question is it enough? Mm-hmm. For the scale of the need that we have, between 3 to 4 million teachers, is it enough? And there are colleges of education around the country doing amazing things, and I can give you some examples. But the challenge is scaling that up to meet the massive need.
Huge, huge need. Can you give us a sense, Keith, what kind of guidance and structure that these new teachers have that are available at your school? And I'm wondering if it's sufficient.
I don't think it's sufficient because it's mostly after the fact. It's a stopgap measure in some respects. I'm involved with our local union, and I will say our administration in South Lyon, I think, does the best job that we can, both of us, to help new teachers be successful. So there are some structures in place. Our district administration, much of this is mandated by state law. New teachers have 3 to 5 years that they have individual development plans. They're monitored frequently. They're observed more frequently by the administrators. And from a union perspective, we have some supports in place that new teachers can reach out to us, and we'll try to help them before they get in trouble, quite frankly, or start to become that one of the 50% that drop out of the profession by their fifth year.
Now, in your essay for the next idea, you argue that we've known for some time now what we need to do to produce better teachers. What is that?
Well, I referenced that earlier when I talked about Eastern Michigan University, and even all those years ago for me, there was an understanding that we need to get teachers into the classroom earlier and more frequently than maybe traditionally has been the case. And I think that's probably the crux of it. There's more to it, but the criticism of colleges of education is that they've been too theory-based, too much time in a classroom, too much time hearing professors lecture about how to teach rather than actually gaining experience teaching.
Why do you think we don't see more apprenticeship programs?
Probably the cost, quite frankly. I mean, ideally, if I lived in a fantasy world, a first-year teacher would have their entire first year, they'd be a co-teacher with a master teacher or a veteran teacher. You think about it, in the medieval period, apprentices had 7-year, you know, term that they would work with a master craftsman to learn that craft. And I know that's, you know, too much. That's beyond what we could ask for. But even 1 year is too much, because if you have two teachers that essentially could be filled with one position, you're talking about doubling the salary for that classroom. It's money.
It's money, and as you say, it's need. When you're needing 3 to 4 million, you can't have two locked into a classroom. Yeah. You argue that the way forward is to make teaching more professional, not less. How would you do that?
Well, that's, you know, if I had the answer to that, I'd write a book and do a tour. It's a cultural change, which is why it's so difficult. Changing a culture and cultural values is difficult. Until in this country, and I don't know that we'll ever get there, our best students want a teaching degree instead of an MBA, we'll probably always be facing this problem. You know, it's interesting to be a teacher. I go to a party where people don't know me. What do you do? I'm a teacher. Oh, that's wonderful. They say nice things, but it doesn't...
They coo and bill over you.
Yeah, but it doesn't carry the prestige, quite frankly, teaching as some other professions. And until we can change that cultural attitude, a shift in that regard, I think we're going to be challenged to attract the kind of students that we want into teaching. But I think we can't just cross our fingers and wait for that. In the meantime, we can do things to make teaching more attractive and make it a more prestigious occupation. One thing I don't think we want to do necessarily is keep emphasizing this kind of missionary aspect of teaching. And it's wonderful. Don't get me wrong. I love that I work with kids, and I work with former lawyers, former executives, people who wanted to be teachers because they wanted to reach children. But we also need to make it, in my view, a profession and a prestigious profession. That's what, you know, we always get compared to Finland and South Korea and these other countries. In those countries, their best students want to be teachers, and they fight to be in these teacher preparation programs. That, to me, would be the ultimate goal.
Keith Kindred is a social studies teacher at South Lyon East High School, and you can find his essay on the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Would teachers stay longer on the job or be more invested in their jobs if they got paid more? Tomorrow is part of our Learning to Teach series. We talk with the principal and founder of a school in New York that pays its teachers six figures. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Tax season is at a high pitch right now, with that April 15th deadline looming large. It can be complicated enough figuring out what we owe Lansing and owe Uncle Sam. And there's a group facing extra headaches and challenges, same-sex couples in Michigan, because they can file a joint form for their federal taxes, but in the eyes of the state of Michigan, they're considered single. Joe Henchman is Vice President of State Projects at the Tax Foundation in Washington. Welcome to the program, Joe.
Great to be with you.
So here we have the IRS that gave a green light to same-sex married couples to file a joint return. But boy, this sets up a conundrum for these couples in Michigan and the other states that don't recognize same-sex marriage, doesn't it?
Yeah. We started getting into this about a year and a half ago after the IRS made their initial ruling, because there's 22 states at the time that told taxpayers to do two contradictory things. On the one hand, they told taxpayers, you need to make sure that you file the same way that you file on the federal return. So if you file jointly on the federal return, you need to file jointly on the state return. And you need to take all of this information from your federal return and use it in your state return. So whether that be the income line, or you need to take the same deductions or take the same exemptions or whatever it is. So they told them, you know, do the same thing on your state return as you do on your federal return. But at the same time, they said, we don't recognize same-sex marriage. If you're a same-sex married couple, you cannot file jointly.
Wow.
So that set up a conundrum, because you can't do both of those things without violating state law. So we reached out to state tax administrators in those states and asked them, you know, you can't just leave taxpayers with this problem. You need to come up with some guidance for it. And we gave them a couple of different options of what they can do, and every state did that. Now, in this tax filing season, we still have 10 states where this is an issue. A lot more states have recognized same-sex marriage, but there's still 10 states, including Michigan, that don't, but still require taxpayers to use the same information on their federal return as they use on their state return.
So what's to be done for these same-sex couples in Michigan? Because they certainly want to do right by Washington and do right by Lansing.
So we have all of this guidance on our website at taxfoundation.org, and the Michigan Department of Treasury, which collects income tax in Michigan, has it as well. What you do is you fill out kind of a dummy federal return. The official term is a pro forma return. It's not going to be what you file with the federal government. So if you're a same-sex couple, you're filing your joint return with the federal government, but you have to file two single returns with the state government. So how you do that is you basically prepare an extra two federal returns, two single returns, and then you use that as the basis for your state return. Now, normally this would be illegal. Normally, you can't just make up a tax return and use that information. You have to use what you actually file. But the Department of Treasury is advising taxpayers this is how you get out of this conundrum in Michigan.
What are you hearing from couples and from the folks who are doing their taxes? Is this working okay or not?
Certainly not the ideal solution, because it does involve a little bit more paperwork and a little bit more time and effort, of course. It's certainly a better solution than not providing no guidance at all or putting taxpayers in the position of having to break a state law. But, you know, this all goes to the fact that Michigan doesn't recognize same-sex marriage, so they can't, legally at least, you know, in their view, recognize this as a joint filing opportunity. It's in the courts right now. We'll see where it goes. But in the meantime, we want to make sure taxpayers can file their taxes by the deadline without running into any problems.
In fact, certainly we're watching very closely here in Michigan, waiting for that U.S. Supreme Court decision coming later this year. And if that decision legalizes same-sex marriage, let's just jump ahead a year. It hits me that it could be even more convoluted for couples in 2016, because you'd have half the year without, and then after the Supreme Court decision, assuming that it does legalize same-sex marriage, then you have half the year in another situation. So that, to me, seems like it's even a bigger web to untangle.
Well, what we've seen in other states is after the decision comes down, it's kind of viewed that that's kind of the way it's always been. And so you don't have to go back and correct anything, or you don't have to split years. With filing tax returns, you know, if you get married on December 31st, you can still file jointly as if you were married that whole year. Same with kids. If you have a child on December 31st, you still get the full, whether it be an extra deduction or extra exemption or extra child tax credit. You certainly don't have to prorate it in any way. And we haven't seen any states try to do something like that. So if same-sex marriage gets legalized in more states, it'll just make this problem go away for the full year. You won't have to do any part year kind of stuff.
Joe Henchman is with the Tax Foundation in Washington. And once again, Joe, where can people go to get guidance?
At taxfoundation.org, where we've collected all the information from the different revenue departments, including from Alabama, which it's not on their website anymore.
Oh, well, there you go. So it's all there at taxfoundation.org. Joe, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Anytime. Thank you.
And then there were four, the final four. Michigan State coach Tom Izzo is going to his seventh Final Four since 1999, the most Final Fours of any coach this century. Number seven, Michigan State will play number one seed Duke on Saturday in Indianapolis. And we have Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon is here now. And that was one wild, wild ride against Louisville.
Yes, it was, to say the least. A team they were supposed to lose to again. Of course. Louisville, coached by Rick Pitino, has already won a national title at Louisville against Michigan a few years ago. You probably recall that one.
Yep.
And, of course, at Kentucky, who is still around as well. So he's one of the all-time great coaches. So is Izzo. And that was a battle of two masterminds down to the stretch. And the Spartans really, as Izzo even said this, is not his best team. It's not even close. This team, as he said early in the season, I would not have picked them for a Final Four team.
He said he wouldn't have.
Exactly. Where else are you going to go with that one, right?
Yeah. And that first half was so wobbly. And you've got to wonder. I mean, they were down eight at the break. What on earth happened in that locker room that changed things around both Friday night and yesterday?
I speak with zero knowledge here of the actual situation. However, knowing Izzo and knowing what a good coach does, he calmed him down. He calmed him down and got him back to X's and O's it was not an emotional appeal, is my strong hunch, is just trying to block out the gigantic crowd you've got, the pressure, CBS and all the rest, and keep the game between the taped lines. Look, he's been on this high wire many times, and that's where the experience really pays off. The last time Michigan State was in the Final Four was 2010. So it's been 5 years. Not one player on this team has been on there, and he's been to seven. So he knows exactly what it takes, and I'm sure he calmed him down and got him back to basics, and they played that way in the second half. It was not fancy basketball in the second half either, but it was fundamentally sound.
Well, things started seeming to gel. But speaking of calm down, that's not him on the sidelines.
No, it's not.
I think the Italian in Tom Izzo comes out with a vengeance. It's something to say.
It does. He's very rarely on the right side of the tape, which is the painted side. Opponents, including Michigan fans, of course, this drives them nuts that Tom is out in the middle of the court and all that. But look, it's part of his style. He rarely gets called for this, and his players clearly eat it up. I'll say this. When you're around him, when you watch him on camera, he's intense, he's fierce, he very rarely smiles. When you get to him socially, he has a ton of fun, and his players love him. That's not what you see on TV.
Well, this is the guy that showed up at the kickoff rally dressed as a member of KISS, dressed like Gene Simmons, in front of everybody, you know, to get him rallied. So we know he doesn't take himself too seriously.
He does not, and he's a youper after all, and they tend not to as a rule. I don't know if any current basketball player would know who KISS was. That's an our generational thing, but they know he's wearing makeup. So.
He walked it. Well, they're calling this Final Four epic. But we should note, by the way, Saturday's games are on TBS on cable. So, you know, people are a little bit at a disadvantage if they don't have cable. And then Monday night goes back to CBS. So
right.
There is that. What are your concerns as you
By the way, find any bar anywhere.
Yeah.
Or any friend will have this game. Not hard to find.
So what are your concerns as you look ahead to Duke?
They're better. Look, this is a one-seeded team. It's Coach K, Mike Krzyzewski. Mm-hmm. He's won four national titles. This is his 12th Final Four. Not as many as Tom Izzo since 2000, as you pointed out. But no, this is a machine right here. And if you get past them, you got a bigger machine in Kentucky and John Calipari. If that game happens, if you have Izzo versus Calipari, you have, in my book, about as close to good versus evil as you're going to get. For the reasons we talked about before, look, Calipari's not even trying to coach these guys for very long. They're one and dones, which means they don't even go to school second semester of the season. So because you can skip all your classes all semester and you will not be ineligible until about 2 weeks after the March Madness is finished.
And then who cares?
And then who cares? You're out anyway. You're only a one-semester freshman, so whatever. Izzo, on the other hand, has got about an 83-84% graduation rate, which is higher than that of the university itself, which is a heck of a thing when your players are still going to the NBA and things like this. So I have met Calipari briefly. I know Izzo fairly well. For me, it's not even close. Now, if that happens, that is the ultimate Hoosiers game set up where you got this slow guys who can't run as fast, jump as high, and Kentucky will be the hot shots. But do not count this team out.
This team sure has guts. When you're thinking about coming up on Saturday, what about Coach Izzo versus Coach K? Can you compare and contrast Krzyzewski and Izzo?
Yeah, I think that the image of Izzo on the sidelines is, as you say, fiery, intense, screaming and yelling. It's all true. I mean, the camera's not lying.
Yeah, breaking clipboards.
Right, but Coach K seems like the calm, quiet one. Don't believe that either. When he puts his finger on his nose like this and his hand over his mouth, he's doing that for a reason, and that is to make sure you cannot lip sync what he is saying, which is not normally going to run on CBS. it is not G-rated what he's saying to his players. If his finger goes along his nose, it is not G-rated.
You know, it's interesting watching both teams after that Louisville game, and you really do get a sense of what college sports should be and is.
This is why we love it. And as cynical as I get covering this stuff and writing about it, as we all can get and so on, look, man, those tears are not crocodile tears. That's the real thing you're seeing. Absolutely. And how often in life do you see genuine passion where the 20-year-olds who won are throwing the ball up in the air and finding their parents in the stands and they're crying, and the guys who lost are burying their faces in their jerseys and crying in front of the world on the sidelines? That's all real, and we don't get to see that very often. And one of the great things about sports in general is you don't know how it's going to end. And in college sports, the passion overrides still everything else.
And you think of how young they are and what that's going to mean to them throughout the rest of their lives.
I can already tell you, having talked to the 89 championship team from Michigan, I've interviewed Magic Johnson, all these guys. 30 years from now, they will be able to break down these games almost play for play.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon. It's always great to talk with you, John.
Cindy, always a pleasure.
The Final Four will fight it out at Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis on a floor made of Michigan maple.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
Connor Sports is located in the small Upper Peninsula town of Amasa in Iron County. It's the company making not only the floor for the men's Final Four in Indianapolis, but also the women's Final Four in Tampa. Jason Gasbridge is Director of Sustainability for Connor Sports. The company's been around since 1872, even before basketball was invented. Jason, what does it take to make the floor in terms of number of trees, how many steps, how much time?
Well, this year was a little bit special. We had a local school district here in Michigan near Amasa, where our plant is, that owns a school forest. And we actually had a field trip where we had 460 kids from the Forest Park School District come out to their school forest, and we cut down the first tree for this year's men's court.
That's great. So the kids were really a part of it in a very, very special way. And that was the first of how many trees?
You know, a typical floor takes about 30 trees. And it varies from year to year. And, a lot of it depends on the size of the trees.
And what kind of trees?
They are what we call in our industry northern hard maple. So they're hard maple trees that are grown north of the 38th parallel.
What makes them good for the purpose of the Final Four?
Well, it's a very clear wooden. By clear, I mean not that you can see through it, but there are not very many knots. It's very pure white wood. And it's very hard. It's very dense. So it's a very strong wood. And it's very important, especially for the game of basketball, that you have a wood that is hard and dense, because the last thing that you want is, chips or splinters to come off the floor, and it could be disastrous from a injury standpoint.
So how much time from cutting down the trees to having a floor good to go? How much time passes?
So, again, backing up to the September 24th event where the trees were cut, the trees then are transported to a sawmill where the logs are cut into lumber, and the material is dried, and then it comes back to our plant in Amasa where flooring is made, and then it goes through what we call a panelization process, which is where we take the flooring and we attach it to a subfloor system. In those subfloor systems, basically we create a panel that's 4 feet wide, 7 feet long, and that is what makes up the floor. If you look very closely at the floor on TV, you'll notice that you can see there are 4 foot by 7 foot panels that make up the floor. Typically, about 250 panels make up a complete floor. Once the panels are built here in Amasa, they're transported to our finisher. And the finisher that we use this year is located in Utah. That floor is finished. And then, of course, goes on a five-day or so tour, which the floor has toured from Utah all the way into Indianapolis, where it has been installed.
And I've got to imagine people in Amasa, when they're watching the Spartans playing this weekend, knowing that it's a local company that built that floor and the kids were there for the day the first tree was cut down, there has to be a special tie.
It is, yeah. And it's even maybe a little more special, even for kids down in Indianapolis. And the reason I say that is not only did we use lumber from the school forest here in Amasa, but we also took things a step further. The panels that we manufacture have a recycled plastic component in them. And this year, it's a first-time-ever event. We worked with 6 schools in the Indianapolis area, along with Forest Park School District and the West Iron County School District here near our mill in Amasa. And we asked students in all of those 8 schools to collect a very specific type of recycled plastic. It's a number 5, which more commonly would be recognizable as a plastic bottle cap, or yogurt containers are typically made out of that material. Those materials were collected and incorporated into the men's court. So, again, there's just another tie together, not only for our local community, but the community down in the Indianapolis area where the game is being played.
Well, after it's all said and done, and if we were talking next Tuesday after the championship's been decided, what happens to the floor then?
Well, you know, it's a little different every year. So oftentimes the school that wins will purchase the court, and they'll do one of two things with it. They'll either take it back and they'll use it as their home court, or other times they will take it back and they'll cut it into smaller pieces and sell the smaller pieces as memorabilia for the game. And then sometimes they just don't purchase it, and so we'll take the court back and we'll sell it over the course of the year to another facility.
Jason Gasparich is Director of Sustainability for Connor Sports. The Upper Peninsula Company built the hardwood floors being used for the NCAA Men's and Women's Final Four. The company's been making floors for the NCAA Championship Games since 2006. Jason, thanks for speaking with us. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and today's engineer is Tony Brown. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Joe Lindstroth, Annie Norris, Lindsay Scullin, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.